This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show for your Tuesday. Good to have you with us today. Matt Patrick here. We've got Brett Johnson going to stop on by. Patrick Cooligan from the Minnesota Reformer as well a little bit later on. We'll talk with them. Are you staying cool out there? Because this is extraordinary. Everything is just drying out. They've got now water. It's early June. We've got water restrictions already in some cities. Heat strokes are being reported all over the metro area. The roads are blowing up all over the place. This is crazy. And it's going to stay in the 90s all this week, very early. Drink plenty of fluid. Take breaks. Be careful out there. We'll get to a lot of things. Got a lot of stories to talk with today. But starting us off, Nakimi Levy-Armstrong is joining us, renowned civil rights attorney, ordained reverend, former law professor, freedom-fired legal scholar, blogger, national expert on issues of race, public policy, economic justice, public education, juvenile justice, and the criminal justice system. She's an author of several articles and essays focused on racial justice, poverty, incarceration, and the war on drugs. She was involved today in a call for the removal, and I'm pretty much on board with this 100% as well, the removal of the U.S. Marshal for the District of Minnesota after the, what can only be said, the insanely botched and misthought out, whatever you want, police action, I guess would be the right term, that occurred with Winston Smith. She's kind enough today to join us to talk about that press conference and the demands that the U.S. Marshal for Minnesota step down. Nakima, thank you very much. I really appreciate the time.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
I couldn't agree with you more. The tone deafness of any law enforcement agency, I don't care if it's a local police officer, county sheriff, or a federal official in the city of Minneapolis, to be doing anything without cameras on, without complete transparency to the utmost that they can do, is unbelievably inexcusable at this point. And I understand that U.S. Marshal, and we'll get to him because there's a lot of questions on what exactly is going on here. I understand he might think that he's above this, but he's not. And I think we're seeing exactly why that lack of judgment should mean he should resign.
Well, just to clarify, the head of the U.S. Marshal for the District of Minnesota is actually a woman.
Oh.
I think the national head is a man, but it's a woman here named Ramona Doman, who is the previous chief of police for Maple Grove. She is the previous head of the Minnesota Department of Public Safety, and she was appointed by Donald Trump in 2019 to become the head of the U.S. Marshal Service for Minnesota. And so I agree that there is a huge problem with regard to everything that unfolded in the death of Winston Smith at the hands of the U.S. Marshal Service, including the silence of Mona Doman in the aftermath of Winston Smith being killed, all of the unanswered questions, and the fact that the U.S. Marshal Service has chosen to pin this murder of Winston Smith on a Ramsey County deputy and a Hennepin County deputy without further explanation as to why he was even being targeted by them in the first place.
And there is an interesting thing. By the way, and thank you very much for correcting me. I was wrong on that with Ramona. But one of the things which I have been looking for some sort of explanation here, why were the U.S. Marshals involved in this in the first place? There was that false story of a murder suspect. Then it was a gun violation. I was like, wait a minute here. A U.S. Marshal is performing a task force duty on just a person who is not supposed to have a gun? This sounds a lot like what happened up in Brooklyn Center where, you know, all of a sudden it's a TABS violation and that escalated. What do you have any idea why in the world even the U.S. Marshal was involved in this?
Well, I think that a lot of folks would be surprised to believe that two-thirds of the warrants that the U.S. Marshal Services have been involved in are actually local warrants and not federal, mm-hmm. right, which is a shock because we all saw Tommy Lee Jones in The Fugitive and U.S. Marshal. but that's really not the reality in terms of what is currently happening with the U.S. Marshals Service. Part of the problem here is that you have this almost secret law enforcement agency. I mean, they're the oldest federal law enforcement agency in the history of this country. Most people have no idea who they are and what they really do. But there is an article that is circulating called the Marshall Project, and it is an article that gives a lot of information about the troubling recent history of the Marshals. And this was a collaboration between the Marshall Project and USA Today. And they talk about the fact that the Marshals are really just like a local police department, but with less accountability and federal authority and more violence than what you might see with the local police department. So, of course, as you could see with the lack of body camera footage and the lack of dash cam footage, that was initially a federal policy for many, many, many years. And last year, the federal government reversed course, and they said that those participating as part of the U.S. Marshals can actually be allowed to use body cameras, but our District of Minnesota has not yet caught up with federal law. They apparently started rolling out the use of body cameras in February for local authorities that they deputized to become marshals. But those officers, those deputies involved in killing Winston Smith were not wearing body cameras. They were essentially acting as glorified cowboys.
Yeah.
And there have actually been accounts that said that they weren't even looking for Winston Smith initially that day. They were looking for another so-called suspect, and then they got a tip that Winston Smith was at Stella's, and then they reversed course and went and ambushed him on the fifth floor of the parking ramp.
Well, and that's you said the word cowboy, and that's exactly this. I knew that the U.S. Marshals are involved in some local things, but usually most of the times it's like there's a guy that supposedly has arms. We know he's got a lot of arms. So it's a little more thought out. This is not what happened. This was like an impulse. I mean, you sometimes get a law enforcement agency. They see someone committing a crime as it happens, and they go into action. The U.S. Marshals are not supposed to do that. You said cowboy. That's the perfect term here. It almost seems like it was an arrest looking for a target. And they just that day, you know, kind of hell or high water, they were going to find someone to arrest. And that is, to my knowledge, nothing what the U.S. Marshals Service is supposed to be like, because it isn't supposed to be, you know, like a transit cop or a beat cop. It's supposed to be something a little bit more thorough. This is the idea of this is kind of scary, because you're right. This is going into that cowboy territory.
Yes, and I think a lot of us have the perception that it's more than that, but it's not, in the sense that now many of the marshal services across the country are comprised of local law enforcement who have been deputized. And in order to become deputized as a marshal, if you are currently a law enforcement official, or I'm sorry, a police officer or someone, you know, in a law enforcement capacity, all you need is 5 years experience as a law enforcement officer. And even if you have a history of excessive force, as long as you explain the circumstances, you won't necessarily be disqualified from being deputized. And once you're deputized, that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get any additional special training to prepare you for the work. So in other words, you could have a Ramsey County deputy, a Hennepin County deputy that now has the power of the federal government behind it, with far less scrutiny, far less oversight, far less transparency, and far fewer public eyes on their behavior and conduct.
The you brought up the body cameras. I'm going to try to do this the best I can, because this has been a mess to try to follow. So initially, the U.S. Marshal says, no, we don't carry body cameras. The federal government came in and said, no, we're implementing body cameras. We actually, you can wear them if you want. Then Ramsey County Sheriff said, well, we're not going to participate in any more U.S. Marshal activity unless we're wearing body cameras, which from the way that the press release sounds like Ramsey County was getting the okay that that's if you want to do that, you can. But then they reverse course and say, well, since we're being told we can't wear body cameras on U.S. Marshal things, that we're no longer going to participate. It does sound like you can have body cameras on. it just sounds like the U.S. Marshal here in Minnesota is that's they don't want that policy in place because, and let's be blunt, accountability. They don't like the fact that the world can see what they're doing.
I think that that's a big part of it. I mean, so, yes, you have the chronology correct from my understanding, but there's a couple challenges in terms of what happened. Number one, Ramsey County Sheriff Bob Fletcher knew that the marshal service for the District of Minnesota was not using body cameras when he allowed several of his deputies to become deputized. Now, he claims that throughout the years he kept asking about the policy, but he didn't do anything else beyond that. He still allowed them to run around like cowboys. And when you look at the comparison to Minneapolis and St. Paul, neither of their police departments agreed to participate in allowing their officers to become deputized because of that body camera policy. So how do you wait until after a man is killed in broad daylight in a very public place with a low-level, you know, alleged offense, and then you suddenly start making a fuss about the body camera policy? Sheriff Fletcher had a duty before Winston Smith was killed to ensure the use of body cameras or to pull his deputies from the program then. All he's doing now is trying to save face and cover his ass and throw Mona Doman under the bus. She should be thrown under the bus in the sense that this woman has trained at Quantico, you know, in the FBI Academy. This woman has, what, nearly 40 years of law enforcement experience. She also came to the Department of Public Safety in the aftermath of the Metro Gang Strike Force debacle, you know, and the gang databases, you know, being dismantled due to a lack of transparency and accountability. So she knew that there were problems with these task forces, and she still operated as if what they were doing was okay. Now, let's add to the fact that for the last more than 1 year, we've been dealing with the aftermath of the murder of George Floyd at the hands of the Minneapolis Police Department. So as you started out saying, any law enforcement department, agency in Minnesota should be operating with a completely different mindset in the aftermath of George Floyd being killed than they were before. Now, they should have been, you know, having a more rigorous standard, stricter standards prior to George Floyd being killed. We know that wasn't the case. But what is their excuse now?
There's
one
none.
Year later.
Yeah, there is none. And that's the part which is the unawareness. Either it's one of two things. It's a bravado and a level of entitlement that feels like I'm above the law that is driving this, saying that, no, I'm not going to let the world see what I'm doing. Or it is such a complete and total misunderstanding of exactly where Minneapolis-St. Paul is right now to understand that no one trusts you. And I'm not necessarily following the stories from the other side either, because there's no video of this. We don't know what happened on top of that parking garage. All I do know is no one trusts what happened here, because in this day and age, how you don't have every camera you possibly can have turned on to verify what your story is going to be is inexcusable. It is just inexcusable.
I agree, but think about the fact that there is probably some footage available, from my understanding. It may not be body camera footage, but there might be bystander footage available. There were also witnesses from the rooftops, perhaps, of the various restaurants. Winston Smith ate his last meal at Stella's. There were people having lunch at Stella's during that particular time. And remember, there was a witness sitting right next to Winston Smith when they opened fire on him. They had no regard for the woman who was sitting next to him, who was injured as a result of what happened, who was essentially kidnapped by the marshals or the BCA in the aftermath of them killing Winston Smith, and she was not released until the next day. And we don't know what happened in that interview, what was shared, what she witnessed. We don't know what the other witnesses told the BCA. And we don't know why the BCA is even allowed to investigate this, given the conflict of interest between Mona Doman and Drew Evans. Mona is Drew Evans' old boss. So why would we trust? We don't trust the BCA to begin with. But now there's an even greater reason to not trust this investigation because of this glaring conflict of interest.
I want to repeat what you just said. The U.S. Marshal for Minnesota, Mona Doman, She was the boss of the current person in charge of the BCA, the people that investigate the crime.
Yes.
Holy
That's
God.
Drew Evans. Yeah, she became the head of the Department of Public Safety in 2011. Drew, and she was there for 8 years until Donald Trump appointed her as a U.S. Marshal. And in between that time, in 2013, Drew Evans became the head of the BCA. And remember, the media is not paying attention to this. That's why we held a press conference today to bring out facts. We had to do the job of the media. They're so focused on looking through Winston Smith's social media and trying to find evidence of him being a bad guy or a murder suspect that they did not connect the dots that are right in front of them about the history of the U.S. Marshals, the danger that exists with regard to their behavior. They kill on average of 22 people a year between alleged suspects and bystanders. Again, no accountability. They didn't look at any of this stuff. So we had to bring the facts today at this press conference to alert the public of what's really going on. None of us is safe if this is allowed to go on without transparency and accountability and real answers. And now some heads need to roll.
God.
Because a black man died for no reason at all. How many white men who have actually killed people, shot at police, like rounds and rounds, like that guy in Bloomington who killed his wife and shot at two young black women, shot at the police over 40 rounds. They apprehended him alive. So how is it that a black man who just had lunch at Stella's, sitting in the car with the woman, can't be apprehended alive after you've pulled up an unmarked vehicle, ambushed him, trapped him, maybe didn't even say who you were, and killed him? We don't know how many times he was shot.
Yeah, and you know,
all the information not there. No, why? Because they lied and said he was a murder suspect.
And by the way,
no one cared after that.
God bless you, because you're bringing this out. I'm glad you are, because you're right. The media has just been garbage. They're focusing on riots. They're focusing on character assassination. They're not focusing on the fact that the U.S. Marshal was the boss of the people that are investigating, for God's sakes. And
yes.
And we should also mention, we just had a case, the transit cop who witnessed a murder, witnessed someone shooting. She went out, confronted the subject. He went out, confronted the subject, shot the suspect in the leg. The suspect survived, was arrested, was treated. No one died. You can do good police work in the face of a crime. It just when you didn't think the law enforcement in this town could get even more backwards. Oh, my God.
Right. Assuming there was even a crime, right?
There's exactly.
An allegation of a photo on Instagram used to say this was a probation violation. So I'm wondering what role the Department of Corrections played in terms of feeding the marshals information so they could play cowboy and go after him. Because if he was a real threat, why wouldn't MPD be looking for this guy and be the ones apprehending him? Why would it take a federal task force to come after someone who allegedly posted a picture of a gun on Instagram?
First of all, once again, thank you for bringing this to light. Any word if there is going to be any movement on the removal of Mona Doman?
We're waiting to see. All we can do is put the call out and apply the pressure and wait for the governor to respond, wait for President Biden to respond. We think that Governor Waltz should remove all Minnesota law enforcement officers from participation in the Marshals Federal Task Force. There's a lack of transparency. He needs to hold them accountable and say no.
I would agree wholeheartedly with that. I know we've been talking for a while here, and I very much appreciate it. Nakima Levy-Armstrong is joining us right now. I wanted to talk a lot about the 38th in Chicago, the George Floyd Square. Once again this morning, 5 a.m., the city rolled in trying to reopen up the square again. I made the point about a week ago. I said, if the city came on out and said, here's the deal, it cost us $25 million to divert traffic around it, and we could shut down that intersection. You raise the money, we can get it done. I have zero doubt between the corporate sponsors, the people, the regular people, you'd get the money, we could do it. They just seem so damn determined to reopen that intersection up. Your thoughts on the second attempt now to reopen up that intersection?
Well, I don't think it's about money. I think it's about the city moving on with business as usual.
Yeah.
And wanting to erase what happened to George Floyd and have people just drive through like nothing ever happened. And the people who have been holding down the square are saying, no, we put forward at least 24 demands. We want to see the city respond. We want to see a significant change and a commitment by the city to do better by that community, because they let the community deteriorate in terms of some of the conditions and the lack of economic opportunity before George Floyd was killed, not to mention the police abuse that clearly was going on, which we all witnessed a very clear example on May 25th of 2020. And I think one other important thing to note is that the killing of Winston Smith happened on the same day that the city tried to reopen the streets near George Floyd Square the first time around. It's hard to believe that that is a coincidence. So it felt like a double attack on Black people in our community. And we're not out of the woods in terms of the grief, the stress, the trauma, and here the city's at it again. How many streets do they have? Why can't they let the community hold on to one symbol that represents police victims around the world?
Can I make a point? I was just over by the Chain of Lakes, by Badea McCoskey, Harriet. Plenty of intersections over there they've done all sorts of wacky fun things with to basically limit the amount of traffic. This has far more to do with, I think, what that represents than it does with what their ability to do it, because if they wanted to shut that down, they've done it in, frankly, in the wealthy white parts of town. They just don't want to do it over there.
Absolutely. If you go over there, you can see a disinvestment in that community. Mm-hmm. And the community has every right to be upset and to demand more, and to demand that that become a permanent memorial in honor of George Floyd and thousands of police victims around the world.
One last thing. I just want to make sure I mention this to you, because we had you on about a few weeks or 2 weeks ago, I believe. And we've had other civil rights leaders on. And I just want to make sure I point this out to you so you're aware of this. We run this show. We do a live stream of the show on Facebook. And when we've had civil rights talk on this show, Facebook takes us down. I don't know why, but it's very specific and it's very particular. And they took your interview down last time because they said we violated a Disney music violation, which, okay, I don't think we sang Disney songs, but, but needless to say, I'm going to let you know, because you know what? I'm getting real tired of this. There is, you pointed out with the U.S. Marshal Service, we point out with George Floyd Square, this mentality of just keeping the status quo has got to stop. And the threat that these people think just equality means to them is just, it's disturbing. And the reality is we just need to change the dynamic, and just too few people are wanting to talk about it. And so I can't tell you how privileged I am. I'm so lucky that you are willing to take the time and join us today.
Thank you for having me, Matt, and thank you for this platform to be able to share with your viewers what is really going on outside of what they're hearing in mainstream media.
Any time you want on the show, it's yours by all means. Nakimi Levy-Armstrong, thank you very much. We'll take a break. Come on back. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Let's talk the bombshell she dropped there about the chain of command issue we've got going on. Holy God. It's the Matt McNeil Show on AM 950. I never wanted to get too close to you, but now AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. I can't. Okay. So U.S. Marshals got involved in an instantaneous bust. That's not their job. And I know that they were involved in some local stuff. I didn't know it to the extent that Nagima informed me of. I didn't realize it was that much of local bust. That's for sure. Holy cow. But I know they're involved in some. But usually it's like, okay, we got a guy that's stockpiling weapons, or we've got someone who's part of a distribution ring, or bank robber, or something like that. It's not something that's generally impulse. This is impulse. I mentioned the case of the transit cop who witnessed the homicide, shot the suspect in the leg, suspect apprehended, treated, arrested alive. That's how it's done. That's not the U.S. Marshal Service. The U.S. Marshal Service is not supposed to be cowboys in the streets. It's not Dodge City, for God's sakes. It's not the old Cheyenne. And it and what you have to, and Nakima actually brought up an interesting point. How did they get turned on to Winston Smith? How did all of a sudden it was a bust looking for someone to bust? That's what was going on. And that's not supposed to be the U.S. Marshal Service. And so, and she said the probation officers brought that up. I mean, that's an interesting thing. Were probation officers working to get Winston Smith arrested just because they wanted to win that day? The lack of understanding you need cameras. Her very valid point that even if the Hennepin and Ramsey County sheriffs are there, why are you guys out playing cowboys? You shouldn't be out playing cowboys. That the lack of cameras. Once again, the lack of cameras. What did you do with the witness? But folks, if anything you take away from that interview is that the U.S. Marshal, Mona Doman, she is the former boss of the BCA, Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, the guys that investigate the cops. The BCA, the people that are investigating the crime, the U.S. Marshal is their former boss. You guys, and she's right, the media is completely ignoring the fact that this is clearly a massive cluster blank. It is a massive cluster blank. And it doesn't matter if they're at the, and I want to make sure you understand, you have screwed this up so bad, it doesn't matter if there's a crime anymore, because this is, what are you doing here? And she's right, the media, oh, is he a gang banger? Is that what they're kind of, they're trying to do that? Or that's all focused on, look, there's a burning dumpster. I have yet to see anyone explain as well as Nakimi Levi Armstrong did about why the U.S. Marshals were, why they were even there. And she's the only person I've said that, oh, wait a minute here. She's a person who used to be in charge of the BCA. Wouldn't that be like then the last people you would want involved in any of this investigation? Why aren't you calling in the feds to investigate this at this point? Or maybe someone from somewhere that doesn't fall into someone's chain of command at some point. Holy God. And yeah, George Floyd Square. Yeah. Patrick, were we taken off the air for a Disney song violation? A whole new world. A fantastic point of view. Okay, I can tell you right now, they're not going to take that down because it sounds nothing like the song. So, and have we violated the Disney music violation this time?
It seems right now that we are in the clear on that.
Ah.
I was trying to make a Disney music joke, but I couldn't come up with a song that fit.
The last time you did that, you got did kiss the girl, and we had to talk to the cops. Never mind. There you go. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm here all week. Did they just take us off because of that violation? Is the mere mention of the title enough?
Our Facebook stream is blocked for the rest of eternity.
I think that's a win-win. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. Get caught back up. Other news to get to as well. Patrick Cooligan, Brett Johnson, they're coming up in the 5. Stay cool. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. I am stunned. Oh, thank God for there's people like Nakimi Levi Armstrong out there that will actually, you know, give you the details and tell you what's going on. So I do appreciate that. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Why not? We haven't had to talk to Mark and Fridley in a while. Mark and Fridley, welcome on in.
Hey, dude, just want to bring this up, and one of the things I brought to the attention of Mark Dayton in 2006 was Americans being put on terrorist watch list without due process, without any legal proceeding whatsoever. And I've been watched as the national security whistleblower very closely since the early 2000s. Now, there was an incident in Rochester, I don't know if you heard about this or not, it was about 3 weeks ago, that got my attention. And the situation was the Minnesota State Troopers and the Rochester Police Department were doing routine traffic stops at 6 o'clock in the morning in Rochester. They ended up pulling over a semi-truck and its driver, and they entered into a parking lot at 6 o'clock in the morning. What ended up happening, and what was reported by the Star Tribune, was that at 8 o'clock in the morning, 2 hours after this person was pulled over and within his vehicle, the driver of the vehicle ended up shooting himself twice in the head. And
I saw the story. I did see the story. I hadn't heard the details.
Right. So if what the Star Tribune intimated about this routine traffic stop was that this person was driving without identification or was driving without a CDL, would that be enough to want to take yourself deep in the presence of, you know, to me, this grabbed my attention because the abnormality of it. And there was no follow-up. I tried following up with local law enforcement, and I could never get anybody's response. Mm-hmm. But to me, that was a suspicious activity report.
And Mark, I'm not, you know, I'm open. The first thing that I cross in my mind is, you know, obviously we are living in, especially after the last year, we're living in a world of mental crisis after the pandemic, after a lot of things. And I'm not saying that this is it. I'm not trying to dissuade your argument. I'm just trying to put other arguments on the table as well. It reminds me, I remember there was a guy that I remember that was a business owner who committed suicide via driving his car into a semi up on US 8 north of the metro. And, you know, you wonder why that happens, and then you find out, well, they were having some mental health issues or like this. That is a possibility, but I'm not saying that's necessarily the case. It could be the case, but you're right. If there wasn't a mental health issue, and so the guy doesn't have the right tabs on his license, that gets you to the point of that scenario. I can see where that would bring up a raise a red flag.
You know, and this brings into this the correlation of the January 6th riot insurrection at the Capitol was that if the American people still do not know yet the amount of domestic surveillance that's taking place through social media and through telephone calls. In fact, President Biden on Saturday, which is the day that everybody should be paying attention to the news, stated that the Department of Justice and the FBI would no longer be monitoring or recording or surveilling the email and phone call transmissions of reporters and journalists, which is a stunning admission, because what you're saying is that the government forever has been violating FISA.
And Mark, I'm going to step in here because thank you. I appreciate the phone call. Thanks for the heads up. I'll look into that Rochester thing a little bit. We're kind of getting large swath there. Okay. We're starting to go large swath. I got a lot of other things I got to get to. We got Patrick Cooligan coming up here. It's good to hear from you. Check back in before too long. All right. 952-946-6205. By the way, thank you very much to Todd Colet, the lucky duck who lives in Spain. Oh, try the seafood. If you get to the coast, mwah, magnificent. And the red wines too. Delicious. But he, of course, likes the station, can't support us with their sponsors because he lives in Spain, and so he sponsors the station. You can sponsor us, too. 952-946-8885, 952-946-8885. Sponsor the show for a week or 2 weeks if you like. You're more than welcome to do that. Todd wants to remind everyone that we got the biggest fight ahead of us because they are trying to stop the vast majority of us from voting. Trust me, if Republicans could get their way, they would go back to white male landowners are the only people that can vote in this country because that's the only way they're eventually going to stay in power. Well, the reality is there are groups out there that are fighting to try to keep our vote good, including fairfight.com, the League of Women Voters.org. I'll link to both of them. Join their fights, join their campaigns, and we'll go from there. 952-946-6205. Thank you very much, Todd. I do appreciate that the help here. I wanted to start off here as well. Not much learning happened Monday in North Minneapolis' Olson Middle School. Temperatures in some classrooms reached 97 degrees by 9 a.m. Teachers moved classes on the third floor to the first floor cafeteria where it was cooler, but just by a few degrees because only about half the school's 400 students are learning in person. They had more room to spread out. Students lined up along the lockers in the hallway by the main office to catch a breeze from the large fan. there isn't a lot of actual teaching going on because teachers are prioritizing student safety, their own safety. This is according to Laura Henry, a teacher at the special assignment. That is an experienced teacher who provides support to the other educators at Olson Middle School. We've been trying to survive. Because of COVID restrictions, students and teachers couldn't drink directly from water fountains. They could refill water bottles, but most students didn't have bottles to refill. Teachers spent their own money on cups, water bottles, and freeze pops. And masks were just made everyone more uncomfortable. By Monday afternoon, the school district announced it would be sending 15 schools, including Olson, into distance learning from Tuesday through Thursday. The weather forecast shows temperatures reaching the 90s in the next 3 days. After a hot weekend, about 6,500 students attend the 15 schools, either in person or through distance learning. At Lake Harriet Upper School classrooms, temperatures reached 93 degrees in a classroom by 7:35 a.m., according to the form of the thermometer provided by the Minneapolis Federation of Teachers. Greta Callahan, the president of the union's teacher chapter, says some classrooms have reached over 100 degrees. St. Paul canceled classes, ends the school year early because of extreme heat. I bring this up. I want to make sure I mention this. As they're negotiating an education bill in St. Paul, and the Republicans say, cut, 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 cut. Give the money to private schools. Give the money to vouchers. We have two major school districts in the state where the schools don't have air conditioning in 2021. And let's just cut the crap. The reason why these schools don't is they cater predominantly to minority students. And the mostly white Republican Party in this state does not care about them. Because that is a travesty. And I would be saying the same thing if there is a rural school. If there's a 300-person school out on the prairie that does not have air conditioning, what the hell is going on? Are we waiting for the ice truck to stop on by? Do not tell me when you have this many schools that can't function because by 8 in the morning it's 95 degrees in a classroom. Don't talk to me about quality of education. Don't talk to me about failing teachers. Don't talk to me about kids that just don't have the motivation. We've got a plate. You can't put kids in saunas and expect them to learn. And if you're too stupid to understand that, Republican senators and representatives, then get out of that and go back to school and learn it. Morons, for God's sakes. How in the world can you be sitting there negotiating education bills and talking about giving all the money to private schools, giving all the money to vouchers, and you've got public schools where those kids are not going to be welcomed into the voucher program. They're not going to be welcomed into the private schools. They're not. They're going to just be left there in their unair-conditioned, substandard schools. That is unacceptable. That should be the number one issue on this education bill. Making sure every school in the state has basic functioning heat and air conditioning. God, isn't it just amazing how Republicans can remove the entire existence that they have created in these schools where they don't have funds, where the teachers are having to buy cups for kids? Where the classroom is intolerable as far as a learning experience. But that doesn't matter because why aren't the kids all getting A's? Voucher, voucher, voucher. And by the way, a reminder, the voucher program's not for those kids. They'll use those kids as a prop. But those voucher programs were for the wealthy kids in the wealthy white suburban schools to have their parents enroll them into a private school and have the taxpayers, including the people stuck in the schools without air conditioning, pay for that wealthy kid's private school experience. Dear Lord, it's 2021. How in the hell do we have this many schools that don't have a functioning air conditioner? Tax the wealthy, put air conditioners on all these schools, and I don't care if they're metro area or rural, and just be done with it. And if you can't see the value in doing that, if all of a sudden it's like, well, gee, willikers, golly gosh, that's going to cost something, then you shouldn't be on the education committee. Because if you can't understand that kids can't be put into saunas and be educated, then you shouldn't be making any choices whatsoever when it comes to education. Dear Lord. we had to shut down two of the major, a large part of the largest school district in the state. And I think St. Paul is the second or I think third. Yeah, I'm thinking Anoka Hennepin's bigger. The entire St. Paul is shut down. 97, 98 degrees in classrooms. And yet these people saying, why aren't they learning? The arrogance of it all. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. Come on back. Gare, I'll take your phone call when I do return. It is the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. Little Billy is passed out from heat exhaustion. Did he get an A before he passed out? Then the teacher failed. Jesus. Wow, what a messed up world we're in right now. Gary is in Minneapolis. Welcome on in, Gary Bear.
Hi, Matt. Nice to hear your voice again. I was out of town a little while, but I was just going to say, you know, the Republicans love the NRA and guns and their poverty-promoting policies. They work together to make us a shining city in the hills, what they called it. I think we lead the world in gun deaths and poverty among the developed world, too.
Thanks, Gary. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Always good to hear from Gary. Nice to have you back in town, my friend. Fitger's Inn manager, John Klemm, K-L-E-M-M-E, is having trouble finding housekeepers. Although Duluth Hotel position isn't exactly in high demand in a normal year, he hasn't been able to find any applicants to fill the job openings for the tourist season this year as things begin to reopen after the COVID-19 pandemic. All right. We are currently about five housekeepers short from what we anticipate. We probably the busiest summer we've had, said Klemm. To try to attract workers, by the way, this story of the Duluth Tribune. To try to attract workers, the job's starting wage is now $15 an hour, an increase of $3.50 per hour. Klemm said in the worst case scenario, other Fitger's management and staff would have to step in and help clean rooms, or they would have to change the check-in and check-out times to allow more time between guests. However, as right now, he doesn't impact that resort. They'll impact the resort. I want to stop and point out two things about this story which make me ask the question is, are you really sure you're incredulous about why this is happening to you? Your own story says you just raised the minimum wage to $15 an hour from, if my math is correct, $11.50 to clean hotel rooms. Yeah. I've been in a lot of hotel rooms. I have yet to see a clean one. Well, I shouldn't say that. I've been to some very nice hotels, and they have been relatively clean. But I've been to a lot of. There is one hotel. It is involved with a water park somewhere north of the metro. I'll just say it like that. And I checked into the hotel. And there was blood in the sink. And I'm going to say to myself, you know, I might miss a little cleaning here, some dusting here, a piece of wrapper I might have accidentally dropped on the floor, didn't switch out the soaps and stuff like that. The bloodletting scene that happened in the bathroom, I think I would have caught that if I was cleaning. So you have a job that was paying $11.50 an hour to do one of the more disgusting jobs in our society, and it is thankless, and it is disturbing when it is even done right. And you're saying to yourself, it's a mystery why you can't find people to work for you. I get it. I get it. You want to blame a boogeyman. But the reality is the boogeyman is not the $300 in extra unemployment benefits, which people are clearly needing and is helping our economy get back going. Because one of the reasons why your hotel is going to be busy this summer is people actually have some discretionary money and are actually going on a vacation, which you don't want to factor that into your equation, do you? You don't want to factor that in there, that the fact that that money is actually helping your business in the long run. But it's the fact that you just want to just focus on stop paying these people and get them in here and make them work. It's a crap job, dude. It's a relatively thankless job. And there are a lot of people that come in here that are willing to do it, and God bless them. But if you're not going to pay them and they can go get paid better someplace else, you can't sit there and act as if you're why is no one want to damn that federal government trying to give people a livable life? Lee's Pizza in Duluth had to change its hours and delivery radius because it only has one cook and one delivery driver. Shorty's Pizza and Smoked Meats in Superior announced last week it closed a restaurant for good, citing lack of employees. Fauché, well, you're not willing to pay the people. Whose problem is that? Fauché says the manufacturing industry is short-staffed, many entry-level jobs. Everyone wants to blame the extra $300. This story goes on to say, in unemployment, that's not entirely it, Fauché said. It certainly is making it easier for folks who are deciding not to look for work, but that's not the only reason people are holding back. People don't want to work crap jobs for crap wages. So if your option is, well, I can just stay on unemployment and get the $300 a month or week, well, I'll take that as opposed to go scrub bathrooms in a hotel for $11.50 or work for some restaurant who doesn't even want to try to raise their wages. Come on, guys. This story is getting old. It's getting old fast. The reason why these places are busy is because of that money, and you're not factoring that in. We'll take a break. Hour two coming up next. Aha! Yes, indeed. Portions of this program may be pre-recorded. Am I pre-recorded? Hello? Oh, it's me. Hi, Matt McNeil Show. Brett and I here actually live in studio today, which is
got to
nice.
Reset the tape recorder. We're playing for you.
Dang it, that took all day. Good news, we didn't. Nakima Levy Armstrong's interview did not get taken down this time, which is nice because we're a Disney music violation.
You guys got the memo of not singing Disney songs during your interview?
Well, I was going to go with some Warner Brothers hits, but, you know, it's mostly, you know, dirge music. I'm not a big fan. Speaking of not a big fan, okay, this is turning, man. This heat is it's bad. I mean, the only real, you know, if you live in Minnesota and you're like in 90 degrees, what's wrong with you? You're a sycophant. You're Houston. You got to go south. I mean, this is not normal. Those first few days to take it, but now we're day six now. Yeah, today's day six. If we go all the way to Friday, we'll have the third longest stretch of 90-degree temperatures. We'll tie for the third longest stretch of 90-degree temperatures in the state's history. We will also have, and this is the point that Sven brought this up on his Twitter feed, this is so abso-freaking-lutely unnormal. This is a month before this has ever happened before in the state. Every other time it's happened after July 1st. It's never happened like this. And this is, and today would be, it's 6 days today. It will be 9 days by Friday. Six is the most 90-degree days in a row we've ever had in June, so nine is extraordinary.
As I looked at that extended forecast, too, it looks like we're going to be pretty close to 90 even next weekend and next week.
All the way through June?
Yeah.
I was looking at it down in like mid-June, late the early 20s, 21st, 22nd, they're saying it's 90, 91. Everything's drying out. It looks like late August at this point. My yards are actually starting to dry out. I put a hose down on my pine tree in the front to try to get it a little water, and I just after like 45 minutes, the tree had changed two colors again. It is pretty remarkable, and it's the dry too. It's the fact that
dry is the scary part. Yeah, when we could get fires, especially in a few weeks, if we get no precipitation and this weather, it's not going to be good.
And Minnetrista has got a water restriction already in place out there. They're not allowing people to
in June.
I'm used to seeing like Minnehaha Creek where your kayakers are hitting the dirt in late July and August, not in June. The heat wave 85 years ago was really something. It hit 108 on July 14th. 51 people died that day, just alone on that day. That's still short of the record in 1936, Minneapolis-St. Paul, 14 consecutive days in the 90s. That was pretty, remarkable. And 36 there. It's so oppressive that notorious criminal Alvin Karpis pleaded guilty to kidnapping St. Paul Brewery president William Hamm Jr., preferring to face a possible life sentence instead of enduring a trial in the stifling federal courthouse, now Landmark Center, the paper reported. It's nice to know in 1936 when Landmark Center didn't have air conditioning that in 2021 we still have schools that don't have air conditioning. Good job, city planning. What the hell?
Progress.
One of the most robust conditions of climate studies is the average temperatures increase, heat waves becoming more likely and more severe, not just in the upper Midwest, but worldwide, said Axios's Andrew Friedman. There was a story, I think it was on MSNBC this morning, the entire western United States is bone dry. It's bone dry. And you see in California, the guys that grow their almonds, they're just tearing down the trees. There's no point because almonds take so much water to mm-hmm. grow. They're just tearing down the trees because they can't keep them growing. But yet we can't have clean car technology. We need more fossil fuels.
It's madness, yeah. To go this long without any rain and this hot, it's not good.
And we've talked – it's not like we haven't talked about it. I've been on the station for a long time. I remember when I remember in February when my son – it was the year 2002 because Charlie was just born. And it was 72 or 73 in February. And I'm like, that's weird. You know, and we went and hiked around Bidet-Makaska because it was so warm. I remember having a softball game in late April with my daughter. It was 101 degrees in late April. It was one day, just all of a sudden it spiked.
Oh, I know which day you're talking.
You remember that?
Mm-hmm.
I've been up in north. I remember my dad looking just concerned out the window at Christmas on the Iron Range, and it was 42 degrees. He'd never seen anything like it. It's changing, and here we are in June, a 9-day stretch of god awful heat. You got to stay cool. You got to keep drinking water, stay in the shade, not go into apparently the public schools in Minneapolis or St. Paul.
I guess we're just becoming weather wise Iowa or Nebraska essentially.
Oh, I think it's worse. I think we're getting down
like Missouri.
Oh dear God, not Missouri. Ugh. Oh God. I had a friend that did. There's a bike trail that runs from Kansas City to St. Louis, right along the river there. And he said they do all this thing like, come on down, you do the bike trail, you go to the wineries. What they don't tell you is basically it's like biking on the sun because it's god-awful hot and it's god-awful humid. And so it's like 1 mile is like 50, and it was brutal because like it's every 10 miles. You need the wine just to get something in you.
It
takes you – you don't nearly go as far as you end up going down there. One other story I wanted to mention here. Authorities arrived on the scene of a one-vehicle crash in northern Minnesota to find a man – who had passed away 75 feet away from the vehicle in a field. Now, here's where this gets a little weird. So, car crashes. Guy's found 75 feet. What do you think? Right away. No seatbelt, right?
Yeah.
Got thrown from the vehicle. Not the case. The Wadena County Sheriff's Office deputies responded to County Road 26 on 160th Street in Bullards Township just before 10:30 p.m. Monday, receiving a 911 call about a one-vehicle rollover. The car, a 2002 Nissan Maxima, was on its drive side on the north end of 106. Approximately 75 feet to the east of the car, deputies located a man lying in an adjacent field. Investigators believe the man was driving had been wearing his seatbelt at the time of the wreck, but after the rollover, he exited the car only to collapse in the spot where he was found later. So he got out of the car. He survived, at least for a little bit, got out of the car, started walking, and dropped. And that's the first responders. He was airbused to a hospital, but he was pronounced dead. So, the question I have here, and this is, you know, you're on the car on your side. Would it have been better for him to stay in the vehicle?
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah. It's sad. There are just way too many accidents this year. Have you noticed that? Car accidents, motorcycle accidents, all across the state. It's almost every day I'm getting at least one or two fatality accidents across the state. I think people just – they're so used to not having to have speed limits or anything like that. It's scary.
Yeah, you remember last year, traffic jams were basically non-existent, so you could drive 60 miles an hour wherever you wanted to go on the freeway, or 70, however fast you want.
So a lot of people are still trying to do that right now.
Yeah, and that's probably why we're having these accidents.
I'll be interested. I'm going to try to follow up on this one, see if I can find more information, because it would be interesting to find out if that was the case, because I know – any kind of sharp fall accident like that, they say stay in place, don't move the victim, let them get the paramedics get there. Did this unfortunate because he was dazed, because he was in shock, getting out of the car, was that what ended up hurting him more and he passed away?
Well, really, any situation where you're injured, yeah, you're taught not to move, whether you're seeing a sports injury, car accident, or anything. They're not moving you until they figure out what's wrong with you and figure out when it's safe to move.
Well, I remember when I told that I was over at by Ridgedale, and the woman drove her car into the plate again, or the thrift shop. She drove her car into the thrift shop, and she's trying to get out of the car. I'm like, ma'am, seriously, just stay in the car. Just wait for paramedics. Let's let them get here. Let them evaluate you. Just stay there. I was just pleading with her. Here is a case with a one-vehicle accident. No one was there. If he wasn't shocked, that might have been the difference. So we've got, of course, it is a Tuesday. Means our good friend from the Minnesota Reformer, Patrick Cooligan, joined you.
Yeah, back on the normal Tuesday time, as today we'll be talking about the education budget, which I know you've touched on a little bit. Yeah, who loves school vouchers and
air conditioning? No, vouchers for wealthy white kids.
That's, priorities. Exactly. Yeah, we'll talk a little bit about gambling as well, and some Line 3 protests and how it affects the politics of the DFL. So Patrick, that's what we got lined up.
Beautiful. Patrick Cooligan, Minnesota Reformer with Brett Johnson right here on AM 950.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's a Tuesday afternoon, and that means we're joined by Patrick Cooligan of the Minnesota Reformer. He is their editor-in-chief, and the Minnesota Reformer is a great resource to follow along the latest of what's happening in Minnesota news and politics. Patrick, thanks for coming back on the show today.
Always a pleasure.
All right, I want to start off talking about some protests we saw of Line 3 that were occurring yesterday as part of Treaty People Gathering. By the way, Robert, Wendy, and Ogama with Native Roots Radio provided extensive coverage during their 6 p.m. show yesterday, and I'm sure they'll have more during today's show. But in regards to Line 3, Patrick, it does present quite a challenge to the DFL, since traditionally a lot of Iron Range DFLers were in favor of mining and pipelines. But of course, as we've seen over the past few years, we have fewer and fewer DFLers who are from the Iron Range. And going back to a previous journalism life for you, Patrick, I know you wrote about this back in 2017, as you were talking about how back in 2017, the DFL only had 9 rural state senators as compared to 21 in 2009, and that number has gone even lower since then. So this issue of mining and pipelines has certainly been kind of a thorn in the side of the DFL party.
Right. The division here is a kind of a classic one in Democratic politics between environmentalists and labor unions, and especially in this case, the trade, construction trades. There's a lot of jobs from that pipeline. And then you also throw in indigenous folks who are an important part of the DFL coalition now as well. Interestingly, in that story you referenced, I quoted David Tomasoni, the state senator from up in the Iron Range, and he talked about how he's a pro, he's in favor of the pipeline, and he was talking about how the opposition to pipelines and mines was really costing the DFL a lot of votes in areas like his, and of course he wound up just leaving the party. He now caucuses with the Republicans in the Senate, although he calls himself an independent. So, that fissure is there. It's even in the Walz administration itself. Governor Tim Walz has said that he favors following the process. And at this point, the pipeline is permitted. And so construction is going on. But his governing partner, Lieutenant Governor Peggy Flanagan, is opposed to the pipeline. She said that publicly. So it's definitely an issue that has divided Democrats. And in this age of kind of polarized politics, you're always looking for those soft spots in the other party where, can you create a wedge and divide the other party? And so Republicans definitely see that with this issue. It's only going to become more challenging, I think, as we see the protests at the pipeline become more confrontational, because Governor Tim Walz really has some big and difficult decisions to make about how aggressive he wants to be to break up those protests to allow the construction to go on.
And that potentially could be a big nightmare scenario, at least politically, for both Tim Walz and Peggy Flanagan if the protests do get more confrontational in the coming months, because I'm sure the last thing they want to face heading into a re-election year is trying to figure out what are they doing with protests in northern Minnesota from constituents who normally might vote DFL. It's definitely a challenging position for them, and they're probably going to have to make some decisions in the coming months if those protests do get more confrontational.
Right. I mean, think about how the Dakota Access Pipeline protests were. I mean, it was a very volatile situation. I think that my own hunch is that Lieutenant Governor Flanagan is somebody who sees herself as being one of those protesters. That's kind of her life story, and you know, to be in an administration that is trying to tamp down those protests, I think it's probably going to be very uncomfortable for her. So yeah, we'll just have to see how this plays out.
Moving on and talking about some news coming out of the state legislature, you wrote a piece talking about education funding, which makes up a big portion of the overall state budget, I believe a little bit less than half of the overall expenditures in the state budget. And right now, both members of the DFL and Republicans are exchanging ideas on how they want to fund education in the coming budget cycle. And it's an interesting proposal that was released by the Republicans, because they actually included a 3% increase in funding for schools during the first year and 1.5% in the second year, which is actually more than what the DFL was asking for. But as usual with these things, the devil is in the details. And one of the parts that DFLers are not happy about is the idea that there is still some money that could be used for vouchers or for private schools, which kind of makes it a non-starter. So, yeah, these are some complicated negotiations going on right now. And from the Republican side, yeah, there definitely is some politicking going on where they can say, hey, well, we actually offered more money than what you were asking for, but there still is that money that could be used for vouchers. So complicated negotiations going on in terms of what's happening with the education budget.
Right. It certainly seems like the Republican offer, which you said, is with the 3% increase on the funding formula, the per pupil funding formula, would be the biggest in like 15 years. Pretty significant. But when you throw in the private school vouchers, which would take money from a school district, if a student went to a private school, take money from that, the money that would go, the per pupil spending for that student would go to that student's family, you take it away from a school district. There's just no way. Obviously, the Democrats are going to agree to it. They're opposed to it on principle, and their fiercest political ally, the teachers union, is obviously opposed to it too. These are just draining money away from public schools. So you really have to wonder if it's a serious proposal from the Republicans, and if it's not serious, then why are they making it, and why are they including that big top line number? Well, maybe it's because when we don't come to any agreement, we can blame the other side. So that's certainly what it looks like. They have not funded pre-kindergarten, and so like 4,000 students would lose pre-kindergarten if the Republican proposal went through, which is obviously a terrible deal for those families. So Democrats don't think this is a good faith move. And, you know, the thing is, I mean, the Republican chair of the Senate Education Committee is a guy named Roger Chamberlain. You know, as I was going to write this morning, I decided not to, but I'll say it on the radio. I mean, this is, not only is he not a guy I'd want to be in a negotiation with, he's not really a guy I'd want to be in the same room with. And apparently they're not even really talking. They're just kind of trading emails, even these email offers. And generally, in my experience covering the legislature, whenever people start putting out press releases and having press conferences, that means that they're not really negotiating very seriously.
Yeah, and the clock is certainly ticking right now as we head towards the end of June and we start looking at the idea of having a government shutdown. And if they're still this far apart, and or at least it's being reported that they aren't talking in person quite yet, yeah, it probably increases the chances that we have a government shutdown. And yeah, very frustrating, especially on the Democratic side, when they're looking at this proposal as being a non-starter, when essentially they're putting in a poison pill with those private school vouchers that the DFL will never vote for. But going back to that 3% funding increase that Republicans proposed, it is more than the 2% the Dems asked for. So, yeah, perhaps there is some politicking going on right there where the Republicans can say we at least made an attempt. But I have to imagine if they took out that proposal for private school vouchers, I would be hesitant to believe that the Republicans would still be agreeing to a 3% funding increase.
Right. I mean, it certainly looks like something that they've done for PR purposes. Mm-hmm. There's also a philosophical debate about whether or not you should give a bunch of money to school districts or whether the Department of Education should be making determinations based on what district needs are. And, you know, there seems to be a funding imbalance based on property tax, because that's how a lot of schools are funded, through property taxes, and some communities are obviously poorer than others. And by giving the Department of Education more authority and money to spend, you have a chance to equalize some of that imbalance. And so there is a philosophical difference there. Democrats would like to see that, whereas Republicans want to just give money to more money to school districts without what they say is interference from St. Paul.
So switching gears now, I want to talk a little bit about a piece you wrote today about gambling and addiction. It is something that we don't often think about as being a problem in Minnesota, but as you write about in your column, it definitely has been an issue for a lot of people, especially with the emergence of electronic poll tabs, which a lot of politicians have called a success, especially when it comes to funding charities and, of course, the infamous Viking stadiums. But Patrick, you were someone who lived in Las Vegas for a number of years, and you've seen the issues that gambling has caused with addiction with a number of people. I think it's important to point out that while these e-poll tabs are certainly funding things like the Viking stadium and charities, gambling money doesn't come from nowhere. It comes from someone, and oftentimes it's from vulnerable populations.
Right. I want to be clear. I'm not arguing that we should prohibit gambling. I don't think that's usually effective when government tries to stop some behavior. But we ought to be doing a lot more awareness campaigns and paying for a lot more treatment. There's only one treatment facility with inpatient beds for gambling addiction, which is just it's shocking. And I relied a lot on a report that came out of state government that said that something like 56,000 Minnesota adults are problem gamblers. I mean, that means that they're gambling addicts. So they're basically, they've lost control and they're spending everything they have. Then there's another, I think it's 150,000 who are called at risk. And what's particularly distressing is that a lot of this, the rates are higher for people who make $30,000 a year or less, for people who have a high school diploma or less. The people who can least afford it are often getting caught up in this. There's all kinds of attached social problems. I think it flies under the radar because there's so much shame and secrecy around money in American culture and around this. Around gambling in particular. Having lived in Las Vegas, as you said, I mean, it's not the fact that people even have a conversation here about whether or not it's addictive or not is to me it's anachronistic. I mean, we know from brain science that it really, for some people, it's going to hit that pleasure part of the brain in the same way that drugs and alcohol do. And it's also going to shut down the self-regulating parts of the prefrontal cortex that you need to control those impulses, and that's how people can really just get caught up. And unlike drugs or alcohol, where you know you're in the worst kind of alcohol bender over a weekend, it's you know several hundred dollars, I guess. But with gambling, I mean, you can lose so much more money so much faster, And then, you know, with our kind of easy credit in our country, it's just so easy to get deeply, deeply in debt. And gambling addicts have much higher rates of suicidal thoughts and completed suicide than other addicts. So I'm just trying to raise awareness about it. There is all this money coming in to the state, the stadium fund, and these politicians that I hear who are almost like gleeful about it. And it's like, that is so short-sighted because that money, as you said, it didn't just appear. It came from somebody's pocket, and it's probably somebody who can't afford to lose that money. And we ought to be spending a lot more of our money on outreach and advertising and education, and as well as treatment.
Oh, and that's just insane that you were talking about in your piece today how we have such a lack of treatment options available for people who do have gambling addiction. So it's very tough to even recover if you do have that addiction, and I'm sure that's especially true if you live in rural Minnesota where you don't have access to those types of facilities. So that just really, I think, compounds the problem too.
Yeah, one facility, 20 inpatient beds, 30 days and you're out, and good luck to you.
Yeah.
And the amount that we spend on drugs and alcohol treatment compared, we only spend 25 cents for every Minnesotan on gambling addiction programs, 25 cents per person. I mean, it's a paltry sum compared to something, I think $46 or something, I can't remember. But the amount that we spend on drug and alcohol, and we should spend that much on drug and alcohol treatment, we should probably spend a lot more. But we got to figure out include gambling in that continuum of treatment care.
Absolutely. And going back to what you were talking about with politicians, I wouldn't necessarily say celebrating or whatever the exact term we were talking about in terms of how they view electronic poll tabs, but I can see that as being beneficial for politicians when they can say, well, wait a second, we can raise money without increasing income or sales taxes. Yeah, it's a very appealing thing to have for politicians, an available tool to have in their disposal to increase revenue for the budget without actually having to directly increase anyone's taxes. So I can see that as being something where politicians are kind of happy about that, even though there are vast costs, as we've been talking about for the past few minutes.
Yeah, I don't think it's any coincidence that, you know, once the anti-tax revolt is launched in California in 1978, and then there's Ronald Reagan, and we starve government for the next, you know, several decades, that I don't think it's a coincidence at the same time we incrementally legalize gambling throughout the country, and because they do see it as a way to raise revenue to pay for necessary services without having to go to the voters and ask them to make tough choices. It just seems like easy money, but it's, you know, like, there's just, in public policy, there's always trade-offs and nothing is free.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're just about out of time, as we've been speaking with Patrick Houlihan of the Minnesota Reformer. I encourage you to check out his piece about gambling in Minnesota over at MinnesotaReformer.com, as well as the other great news stories they have. Again, MinnesotaReformer.com. Patrick, as always, appreciate the time today.
Thanks. Good to be here.
And by the way, make sure you check out their podcast, Reformer Radio. You can find that over at MinnesotaReformer.com. We'll take a break and turn things back over to Matt McNeil up next on AM 950.
AM 950, the progressive voice of this town and of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. How about that nice take? It's a good article. If you haven't read the Cooligan article on the gambling, you know, that's the thing with Republicans. What they try to do is they say, well, we're not going to spend the $100 million we need to fix this project. What we're going to do is we're going to do some trickery, some math. We'll do an unfunded mandate. We'll say the project's funded. We'll say the project can go ahead, but then we won't give it any money. Or they'll give it 1/10 of the budget, and then when the project doesn't get built, they'll say the project was a failure. Or they'll do something like, we'll pass gambling, which won't fund the project either, and then basically take the $100 million that was supposed to go for the project and give it to tax breaks to the wealthy. I think one of the biggest questions we're going to have over the next decade is, do we have the guts to finally, as a people, say to ourselves that any one of us, and the vast majority of people in this country, make less than $100,000 a year. The vast majority of us make less than $100,000 a year. And the question then becomes, if we all have to pay taxes for our safety, then we help out at church, we volunteer, we clean up the street, we do Earth Day, we have National Night Out, we do, you know, we're good community members. We do our best. We're law-abiding. We pay our taxes. Why is it that the wealthiest people, the people who depend on the freedom and comfort and security this country gives them. More, far more than us. Trust me. If there's a guy who's a billionaire and me, and we're on the street, and one of us is going to get, it's going to the billionaire. They're going out to the billionaire. Yeah. So he needs the security of the U.S. military. He needs the security of this country. He needs the workforce here. If he is benefiting so much from the society, why isn't he paying at least the same fair share of taxes as the rest of us? And Republicans will, oh, because job creators. Oh, because like, no. I know a lot of people that make $100,000 less a year who are job creators, and they don't get to keep all their money for free. Wealth worshiping has to stop. And I'm not talking about punishing. I'm talking about equality. And that is the word that scares the crap out of Republicans most of all, because they've built a system that's not built on equality, but favoritism, and they don't want to change it. 952-946-6205. Minnesota coronavirus update. And also, I try to find a little bit more about who exactly is working on line three, and it doesn't go well. I'll talk about that when I do return. It is the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. Let us get into the Minnesota coronavirus update for today. Two key COVID-19 metrics reached historic lows in Minnesota, with the positivity rate of diagnostic testing declining to 2.3% and the number of hospitalizations related to the infectious disease dropping to only 201. The declining positivity rate indicates new levels of viral transmission in Minnesota, where 63.1% of eligible people 12 and older have received a COVID-19 vaccine. The Minnesota Department of Health still reported on Tuesday another 125 diagnosed infections with the coronavirus that causes COVID-19 and two deaths, and raising the state's pandemic totals to 603,005 infections, 7,469 deaths. Governor Walz is scheduled Tuesday to appear at the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport to promote the single-dose vaccination pop-up site for travelers, part of the state's campaign to provide vaccine to 70% of the people 16 and older to state by July 1st. The state is on pace to fall just short of that goal, having provided vaccine to 65.3% of people in that age group so far. But health officials say they intend to encourage vaccination beyond the date anyway and push for an even higher rate of 70%. The nearly 3 million Minnesotans who have received COVID-19 vaccination include more than 2.6 million people who've completed the one- or two-dose series. People are considered fully vaccinated 14 days after they receive the final dose, giving them immune system time to respond to the vaccine and become protective against the coronavirus. Minnesota has reached the first-dose vaccination rate of 89.9% in senior citizens, a vulnerable population that has suffered 88% of the state's COVID-19 deaths. Health officials believe vaccination progress in vulnerable populations, including long-term care residents, has reduced the amount of severe COVID-19 illness. And it has. I don't think it's really that much of a surprise that the efforts to get the senior citizens who were being, the greatest generation didn't deserve this. We have to. One of the things which is the most disturbing part about this entire last year is that, say, in 2018, if I was to say to you, 603,005 Minnesotans were going to get sick in little more than 1 year from one disease, we'd all be shocked. And we are so, warped. Our social media and the internet and the way and our just kind of trying to get out of this has warped our mentalities that, people are like, 603,000 people got sick in the state of Minnesota. Yeah, whatever. Yeah, okay. It wasn't me. Sucks to be them. 7,469 people died. A lot of those people were the greatest generation. And they, from what they went through and all that stuff, they didn't deserve to go out like that. No one did. I'm glad we're getting there. It is really disturbing, unfortunately, the clear amount of and let's just call it what it is, Republican counties in the state where they want to believe the conspiracy theories, their uneducated diagnoses, their you know, their scare tactics. They want to believe that over being healthy. And all I can say is this, is that eventually all this, we're going to get to a point where the infrastructure that we have in place to take care of, you know, coronavirus is going to dwindle. And what it means is this, is we're eventually going to get, for the most part, past it. We're going to get to a point where it's just, there's going to be people that get coronavirus, like they get the flu every year. Most people won't, because they'll be getting vaccinated. I'll get vaccinated. If it's an annual vaccination, I'll be getting annually vaccinated. I'll make sure I'm good. I have no problem with that. But there are going to be these areas of our state where the people are going to be like, it's still a myth. And they're going to be on a respirator in a hospital, maybe with no one else who's sick, but just themselves, screaming at nurses saying, you've made this up. This is not really what it is. And they're really dying of coronavirus. And the problem for them is that here is your opportunity. Here is your chance. The state is doing everything. For God's sakes, they're over at MSP trying to jab anyone that walks on by, which, by the way, if I can make a point, I'm not quite sure if MSP, if you're wanting to make sure bang for the buck and getting Minnesotans vaccinated, MSP is where you want to do it. But still, I guess, you know, goodwill towards all. But needless to say, anywhere you go that's got a vaccination, it's walk in, pick an arm, off you go, knock yourself out. And you're not going to do it. And eventually what's going to happen is all this infrastructure we have in place to help deal with this will eventually go away, because it's going to become a lesser disease. But not for you. Because all of a sudden that vaccine, which is free right now, might end up costing money, because they don't need it. It's a specialty product at the moment. We vaccinated most people. Or the treatment that is being subsidized in a lot of states by the federal government, the coronavirus monies that have been coming in to help out the healthcare, that's not going to be there. That's all going to be on you. And if you don't have health insurance, I mean, hopefully you're not in the hospital for weeks and weeks and weeks and months. Not one of these people that have, you know, 10 months of recurring symptoms, recurring medical bills. If for no other reason, there it is right there. Just go get vaccinated. And so you get poked twice or once, depending on what you get. You get poked once, poked twice, done. And then, yeah, sure, you can go up on your conspiracy rant boards and talk about how Zuckerberg's going to control me with the microchip tonight. You can knock yourself out, but the reality is then at least, you know, in your own mind, you don't have to tell us, you don't have to post it, you don't have to do anything. But in your own mind, you can say to yourself, well, you know, all right, sure, I'm going to rant and talk about how, you know, it's bleach and I grew a third head out of my back. Third head. Never mind. You get my point. I don't get my point. I was a third head. Never mind. But you can go out and rant all day long, but then in the private of your own home, you say, you know what, my wife, my kids, myself, we're all vaccinated. No one else needs to know. We're covered. That way, it's not catastrophic beyond the illness. All right? Think about it that way. It's preventive medicine. And, you know, I know there's a lot of people out there, I broke my leg and I still hauled that mule over my shoulder. That's great. That's wonderful. Wonderful story. I'll actually deal with actual getting healed and going from there. So I think, once again, it's not a surprise that things are getting better. But now is not the time to just stop and just shrug your shoulders and say, well, they're all vaccinated, I don't have to be. Because I can tell you right now, especially in some of these Republican counties where these Republican politicians are, that are out there screaming, it's like, don't trust the vaccines. All of a sudden, they're going to have a break. They're going to have some, you know, Billy Bob's barbecue pit's going to have a 2-for-1 night, and half the staff is going to get sick and be sick. And people are going to be like, why isn't the state have the infrastructure to help us 4 years after the pandemic? Well, because it's 4 years after the pandemic. You're supposed to get vaccinated. You're supposed to be all better. And you're going to be sitting there feeling like you got left out because you chose not to participate. And then your argument just basically becomes, well, I was an idiot. You should have stopped me. And no, that really is not our job. I got a funny story for you. That is not our job. We're not here to stop you from being stupid. I mean, we can tell you you're being stupid. We can beg you to not be stupid, but you want to be stupid. That's on you. The new report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention suggested the two-dose Pfizer-Moderna vaccines are highly effective, reducing the risk of infection by 91% for fully vaccinated people. Studies based on real-world vaccination experiences, healthcare providers, and first responders in Duluth and seven other regions in the U.S. who initiated before approval the single-dose Johnson & Johnson. The CDC reported Monday that also shows milder illnesses and fewer hospitalizations among the few vaccinated people who did suffer through the breakthrough of the coronavirus infections. That's the other thing, too. It really is remarkable that if you do get vaccinated and you do get coronavirus, it is a much milder version. And I think, was it? Okay, and I'm trying to remember the article. I think they said only two people that had been vaccinated that got coronavirus had long-term care, that with basically the symptoms were gone within a week with anyone that got vaccinated, which is really remarkable, actually. Minnesota has been among the most aggressive states in searching for breakthrough infections, identifying 2,868 as Monday as 2.6 million fully vaccinated individuals for a rate of 0.1% of Minnesota's known breakthrough infections, including 290 people who were hospitalized, 338 people who were in ICU there. The CDC study wasn't inclusive, but also showed the low risk viral levels of breakthrough cases that vaccinated people are less likely to spread the coronavirus to others. While we While we cannot make a claim about reduced transmissibility from this data, lower viral loads and shorter shredding time reduce the spread of the other viruses, and it does inspire some protections about the likelihood of transmissibility as well. So Star Tribune on that one. Get vaccinated. And like I said, if you don't want anything else, in 4 years, in 5 years, when your rural community, your rural Republican district, which was so proud, we thumbed our nose at Governor Walz, all of a sudden has 20 cases, and the state doesn't really have a coronavirus reaction force anymore because we've, for the most part, the state's moved past it, well, that's going to be out of your own pocket then. And that's adding insult to injury. So just get vaccinated now and we can be done with it, okay? 952-946-6205. We'll come back. One thing about line three that we need to talk about once again is it doesn't sound like I haven't seen the new jobs report, but I don't think they're hiring the Minnesotans they said they were going to hire, and I don't think they're hiring the union jobs they said they're going to hire. I think they're well below on both those numbers. We'll talk about that. It is the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. So I wanted to go back and revisit a story about Line 3 that I was trying to find out the numbers on this. And a funny story, they don't seem to be too forthcoming. Earlier this year, there was a story about the jobs that were being offered here. Because reminder, there's a lot of people behind Line 3 and a lot of these pro, fossil fuel job union guys were screaming, Minnesota jobs, union jobs, job, 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 jobs. And that's their whole thing. And that's their entire argument. That sure, we're going to poison the crap out of the land and the water. We're going to poison everything. We'll destroy it. We don't care. We get jobs. But then there were stories earlier this year that showed, and by the way, this is Enbridge's job promise, about 8,600 jobs, 8,600 jobs, 6,500 of them local in Minnesota over the two-year period, including 4,200 union construction jobs, half of which are expected to be filled locally. So 75% of the jobs, 6,500 out of 8,600 were to be local. Well, the fourth quarter of 2020, they filed their numbers late, to my knowledge. And of the workers, once again, 4,200 union construction jobs and supposed to be 6,500 local Minnesota jobs, they were horribly, horribly behind. First of all, in the total hiring numbers, they weren't even close to 8,600. Of the people that were hired, which was 4,600 or so, so basically almost a little more than half of what was promised, only 33%, not 75%, were Minnesota residents. And a lot of them weren't union jobs. Funny story, it's like they were lying. I know. And by the way, there was also reports out of Beltrami County that a lot of these people were coming in here, non-union, staying in homeless shelters there, causing a lot of problems up in some of those northern towns. Yeah, great. Nice return. So, but this was a while back, and so and they said, well, when the next report is filed, you'll see. We'll have fixed this and gotten it up to, I guess, their promise was the 6,500 Minnesota jobs and 4,200 construction jobs. Funny story, I can't find any of their updated reports. I looked all over the place, couldn't find a dang one of them saying that, no, they've fixed this problem, that it's no longer just 33, that's 75, and all those unions got the job. Now, I think we already know it's not going to materialize. This was just a bunch of propaganda to push an agenda, and anyone that was dumb enough to follow through on it, you get what you deserve. But let me just say something to the union guys out there who push this project. You do understand, as much as they have failed you here, and yet you are still their little lapdogs, there are two immediate projects you guys could do here that would instantaneously, dramatically increase, would give you a heck of a lot more than 4,200 union jobs on that one site. Two of them. The first one is more light rail. I know. They're building the one right here. As a matter of fact, it's going to go right by the radio station. The Southwest Light Rail Line. That is a lot of good jobs. Those are a lot of local jobs. Those are a lot of union jobs. And they're far more long-term than this oil rig jobs. These oil pipeline jobs are being shipped in from non-union guys, probably from Oklahoma, to come up here and work. That's good work. And right now in the metro area, I can make an argument you could run a light rail line out to the east, run to the west, run the Botno line, and get those lines built. And that would be good union jobs, paying better, hiring more local Minnesotans, and getting you a longer-term payout. The other one is even simpler. Part of our problem with our taconite industry, you want to just stay with mining? Okay, fine, let's stay with mining. Part of the problem we have with taconite is we have no foundries left in the United States. They've shut them down and they've shipped them overseas. If the federal government stepped up here today and subsidized three brand-new foundries, steel foundries in the United States, and kept them operating, kept them going, we would have every taconite miner back to work in this state tomorrow. And there'd be a lot of other good union jobs, putting brand new, top of the line, sparkly new foundries. So we could work with the taconite in the mines we already have that don't involve fossil fuels and don't involve necessarily destroying the boundary waters. And that's long-term, good steel worker jobs. The mines are back to work. The steel workers are back to work. All the union trades get back to work. And if you just think a little bit, just a smidge outside the box, you'd say to yourself, well, heck, that would be a far better return than a stupid pipeline that you guys relied about. I'd love to see your new numbers showing us that you're actually following through on what you promised, but this is me not holding my breath because I already think the reason why we don't know what those numbers are, well, they already know they're not going to give the 6,500 local jobs. They already know they're not going to get the 4,200 union jobs. But it doesn't stop some fools from still saying, isn't it great? No. No, it's not. And then there's that damn pipeline. Robert Pilot, Native Roots Radio, they're up next. You have a good one. We're back tomorrow. Until then, see ya.